This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. And while we may not be going to space today, we are going to my second favorite place that is full of mysteries.
And my favorite place. So what problem are we solving today?
How can the ocean teach us about deep space?
How can the ocean give us clues about deep space? Oh, this episode is right up my alley. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
It is right up your alley, and we are going straight to the source. Today, we have Dr. Julie Huber, who is senior scientist at the one and only Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Julie.
Hi, thanks.
We are so excited to have you. So I want you to tell everyone, what is the deepest part of the ocean you have ever been to? Let's start there.
Literally jump right in.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. My body actually going to the bottom of the ocean in a submarine was about, I have to do the math, it was about 2,300 meters.
Oh,
which
my God.
We need to put into feet. So I don't know, is that 8,000 feet or so? I'm really bad at doing that conversion. But I've also used remotely operated vehicles where I'm safe and dry up on the ship, and we've gone to over 5,000 meters water depth. So
holy
really
cow, that's really, really deep.
Okay. Let's actually take those separately. When you with your body went down, what were you looking for, or what did you find down there?
Yeah, so I was looking, most of what I'm interested in understanding is how life survives in the dark. So how is it that we have amazing animal and microbial communities living at the bottom of the ocean, thousands of meters away from the sun. So that's kind of the problem I'm interested in solving. And to solve it, we have to get to the bottom of the seafloor, the bottom of the ocean, right? And collect samples. And so on that particular dive, I was down there to collect samples to study back in my lab.
So what were you in? Can you tell us about the little mini submarine that you were in?
Yeah, so in that particular dive, I was in what we call a human-occupied vehicle named Alvin. Alvin is maybe one of the most famous submarines in the world, and it's operated by, well, it's actually owned by the U.S. Navy, but operated by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. That's how I got to the seafloor, and it's a pretty great way to spend a day.
So how many people can fit into the Alvin? I'm curious.
So three people can fit into the Alvin, and the way it's normally operated is with a pilot and then two scientists. And, you know, you go in right after breakfast, usually around 8 o'clock in the morning. You spend your day at the bottom of the ocean and you come back just before dinner around 5. So it's a full work day, just in a very...
Sounds amazing.
Okay. Can you give us an idea based on, say, the size of Alvin, based on, say, a small car, an SUV, a minivan?
It's a very small car.
Wow.
Yeah. So those three people, every time you reach out your arm, you're touching another person. I'm about 5'6" and I, you know, you can't stand except in one part that has the ladder going up to the sail. But so, you know, it's tight, but it's quite cozy and comfortable. You know, everyone tries to respect one another's space as much as possible. But you don't dive in a submarine like that if you aren't comfortable in tight quarters.
Oh, I'm sure. So how long does it take you to get down that far?
Yeah, it actually is pretty quick going down. So what they do is the submarine, they put it in the water neutrally buoyant, meaning it just, you know, it's kind of bobbing there. Mm-hmm. And then they release a bunch of ballast so that you just sink to the seafloor pretty quickly.
Oh, wow.
And when I say sink, right, it's a controlled sink. You're kind of gently spinning. And they turn off all the lights to save battery power. It's very peaceful. You know, you look out the windows, and once you kind of leave the photic zone, you start the photic zone being where there is sunlight.
Right.
It's very dark pretty quickly. But then you start seeing bioluminescence, which is how, you know.
I was just going to ask.
Yeah. You know, that's how animals and bacteria and other creatures communicate in the dark, right? They shine these flashes of light. And once your eyes adjust, that's kind of all you see until you get to the bottom.
Okay.
So it's I would say it takes about an hour to get a mile deep. Yeah.
So expanding a little bit on that bioluminescence, because I've done scuba diving before and I've seen that and it's really cool, but I've only ever seen the tiny little flecks. When you're going much deeper, are you seeing anything larger than that bioluminesce?
Oh, definitely. You see, you know, the outlines of really big creatures, you know.
Oh my gosh.
Many feet long. And,
that sounds great.
I have no idea what I was looking at, honest, right? You know, I mostly study stuff that you need a microscope to see. And so I had no idea, but it was really beautiful.
That is so amazing. Okay, so tell us more about your work and working with the microbes. How do you get samples when you're in the Alvin?
Yeah, so whether we're in an Alvin or remotely operated vehicle, we sort of trip out these vehicles with sampling gear. They all have arms so we can pick stuff up off the seafloor. So if you want to pick up some rocks, or maybe you want to use a very fancy vacuum cleaner to suck up some water or grab something else, we deploy experiments on the seafloor. We leave them there for a while, then we come back and pick them up.
Wow.
It's actually really sophisticated what we can do down there.
That is really cool. And
yes,
that connects to any of our listeners that have done any robotics yet. It sounds like a direct connection to, like, that's a skill you need to have and be good at to be able to grab what you want to grab.
Yeah. And, you know, really often what I'm interested in, quote unquote, grabbing is I actually just want to vacuum up a lot of the water that's leaking out of these underwater volcanoes.
Oh,
okay.
Because that's where all of the chemical energy is being released into the ocean.
Yes.
And that's what these microbes living in the dark are using. So instead of energy from the sun, they're using energy leaking out of this volcano. And so I'm trying to capture that energy and the life in it. And so I have a very fancy pump, and then a bunch of bottles and filters and other types of containers to kind of collect as much as I can on the seafloor.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I assume you collect all these bottles inside the Alvin, so then you go up with more than what you came down with.
Well, so everything, is in the front. We call it the basket of Alvin, right? So, you know, or the front of a remotely operated vehicle. And so we often come up heavier than when we first came down. So we rely on the robotics engineers to very carefully ballast the vehicle to make sure we can move up and down in the water column. They have to account for pressure and density and all these physics of the ocean, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I tell them what I want to do and they make sure we can get there and come back.
Which is a good thing, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yay for having them on the team.
Yes.
You just made a comment that brings us back to why you're doing the research of figuring out how the microbes are living and thriving in the dark. Can you say a little bit more about that, since that's what you're studying? I heard you just say they're using energy from the underwater volcanoes. What else have you learned? What else do we know about that?
Yeah, well, you know, it's really fascinating because living up here in the surface world, as we all do, we have grass and we have trees and we have plants. And so we think a lot about the sun, and we know that photosynthesis creates plants and we eat the plant and then maybe the cow eats the plant, that sort of thing. But at the bottom of the ocean, it's kind of flipped over where there's no sun, and these microbes are using things like sulfur and iron and hydrogen that's leaking out of the volcano. Like a plant, they're fixing their own carbon. So we call them autotrophs, right? So
right.
They don't need to like, we have to eat carbon from other things. They can fix their own carbon just like a plant. But right. Instead of light, okay. They're using that chemical energy. We've learned a ton, but I think probably most surprising to me is just how many different ways life can get by in the dark using chemical energy and how much diverse life it can support, despite it being very deep, very far away from the surface world.
Well, and cold too. Can you talk about the temperature too? Because isn't that a factor?
Yeah, well, the deep sea is really interesting because, you know, the deep ocean is very cold. I'm so bad at converting Celsius to Fahrenheit. It's 2 or 4 degrees Celsius, but when you move into these active hydrothermal zones, it can be, you know, in excess of 400 degrees Celsius. Really, really hot.
Wow.
So you
what?
Have this really extreme gradient from super cold to super hot. And most of the microbes are living where those two things are mixing. So okay. In kind of the warm
okay.
zone, right? They're kind of sitting at these boundaries of temperature and energy on the seafloor.
I did not know that the volcanoes let out, that it was that high of a temperature, that deep in the ocean.
Yeah, in those really high temperature black smokers, which maybe you've seen on television, they can get
yes.
that. Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay, so I want to just be specific. I don't know if you were talking about both of them. I had started this line of questioning with, as deep as you have gone inside of Alvin,
mm-hmm.
when you use a remote operated vehicle and you stay up, I like how you say, up on the surface world, are you using that ROV for the same purposes? Are you doing the same thing, just at a deeper level?
A lot of the vehicles can go to similar depths. When you're working really deep, in my experience, it's been more practical to use a remotely operated vehicle just because you can stay down a lot longer.
Mm,
you know,
okay.
when there's no people, you can stay down for days, for example, right? You're just rotating crew, you know, shipboard. So when we've done some really exploratory work where we just need a ton of bottom time, we've used these remotely operated vehicles, but in both cases, I'm going after the same sorts of things. By the time I'm getting to the seafloor to pick up a sample, we've already done a lot of work before that, right? We've found a place of interest on the seafloor.
Right.
We've made a really good map. We've designed some like targets that look interesting on our map, some features. We've gotten some visuals on it, maybe with a camera of some sort. There's a lot of steps before we actually like go down there with all our stuff to pick up our sample.
Right.
Okay, so I do have to ask. So what is the time limit that humans can be down in the Alvin? Because we've had aquanauts on the show and we understand, you know, sometimes you have to breathe nitrox and all that kind of stuff. What do you breathe in the Alvin and how long can you stay down?
Yeah, so I mean, in an emergency situation, you could stay down for days. You know, they
wow.
keep enough.
Yes.
Enough air down there. But unlike scuba diving or things like that, you're not breathing, you know, off of a tank or you don't have a regular air, anything. They just keep, we call it the sphere, which is what you're in, this big titanium sphere at atmospheric pressure. And you're just breathing regular air. But they try to keep the dives between 8 and 12 hours. It's tiring, just like scuba diving, right? Because you're not.
Sure.
You're not super comfortable the whole time and you are breathing fake air. And you're also putting out CO2, right? Which can build
yes.
up. So they're actively scrubbing that out of the submarine. I think every time I, you know, on the ascent coming up, I've fallen asleep. You know, just
okay.
I'm like tired and it's cold at the bottom. There's no temperature control in the sub, so it gets a little bit chilly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's not a place you would like to stay for much longer.
Okay.
Unless it were warmer and maybe bigger.
Right. Bigger, warmer. The
maybe pizza delivery.
Yeah. They have like beds and coffee.
Okay. So now that you've been on the ocean floor, you've told us about how dark it is. You've told us about living far away from the sun and sunlight. And you just mentioned something that very much resembles a spaceship of living in a contained environment that's set to 1 atmospheric pressure, bringing us all the way back to our question, how can studying microbes on the bottom of the ocean help us learn about space?
Well, there's a lot of ways and a lot of connections between, I think, studying planetary science and ocean science. But probably the most exciting discovery in the last 20 years is that we now know Earth is not the only body in our solar system that has liquid water. So we now know there are other ocean worlds, mostly moons of some of the giant planets. So the moon of Saturn, a moon of Jupiter.
Yep.
And the idea that we can have ice-covered moons that have water underneath that ice has really opened up the possibility for thinking about life beyond Earth. That's happened kind of in my life, in my career, sort of our understanding of that possibility.
That's exciting.
In my career, it was very much focused on Mars. We do think Mars used to have wet and warm. But now any mission to Mars is really looking for evidence of past life.
Right.
Whereas these ocean worlds, they offer the opportunity to look for, you know, life now.
Sure.
And that's a pretty profound mission, right? Is there life beyond Earth?
Absolutely. Well, and I've seen stuff, what would this life look like? So are you theorizing maybe that life there might be microbes like we would see deep in the ocean or?
So personally, right?
That's probably not an answer that anyone knows yet.
Right. So one of the things that's really compelling about some of these ocean worlds is that they have a rocky core of their moon, you know, just like Earth.
Yes.
And on Earth, we have this amazing process of plate tectonics, which is constantly recreating new ocean crust, cracking ocean crust, recycling.
Right.
In these ocean worlds, we don't think we have plate tectonics, but instead what you have is just kind of the moons and the planets pulling on each other.
Right.
And that's called tidal forcing. And what that does, though, is it creates cracks. It can create cracks in the ice and the rock.
Oh.
And when you have that type of cracking, the seawater, which I'm calling seawater, I don't know what the composition is, it can react with rock and create chemical energy, just like we have on Earth.
Oh. So
if you have chemical energy, potentially you could have life. These ocean worlds are also very far from the sun. You know, they're in the outer solar system. So the idea of life using energy from the sun is pretty unlikely. So I like thinking about that. I like thinking about, you know, is some of the life that we're finding in our planet being sustained by chemical energy from these water rock reactions? Could it also support life in these ocean worlds?
Wow. That's a pretty significant tie there. I mean, it's a really good theory that's based in fact. I hope you get to find out the answer one day. That would be cool.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, we'll see if it happens in my lifetime. Hopefully at least in my students' lifetime. For sure. But I also think there's a lot of great parallels in terms of, you know, we're working in a really remote environment in both of these fields, right? Planetary science and ocean science. Yes. And the ability to study your environment remotely. You know, we are not going to be sending people to Europa, for example, which is Jupiter.
Not anytime soon.
No, we're not going to be doing that. And in like I said, in a lot of places in the ocean, it's not also not practical to send people. So figuring out, like, how can we detect life, measure chemistry remotely without people physically there, I think is a large part of that. You know, it's another really important connection, I think, between the two fields.
Absolutely.
That is very cool. So for our younger listeners, could you go into a little more definition and explanation of that water and rock, how that can form chemical energy? Because I don't think a lot of our listeners have gotten to that in their sciences yet.
Well, I certainly didn't get into it. Fundamentally, what is happening is you can think of it kind of like a jar of marbles almost, that, you know, we have all these rocks that make up the seafloor, the ocean crust, but it's not a solid mass, right? There's spaces in those rocks, which means seawater can move through the rock.
Yep.
And when it moves through the rock, especially if you heat that rock up a little bit, it releases chemicals from the minerals themselves in the rock. you bake it really high temperature, like you might have in an underwater volcano, you get a huge amount of chemical energy released. But even at low temperatures, slowly you get things released. And so a lot of my work is in these high temperature, you know, really where things happen fast. But we've also worked where things are cold and slow, those reactions, and we can still see life kind of eking by on it. It's harder, right?
Right.
Because makes there's not sense. As much chemical energy, but they manage. So I don't really know what would be happening at the bottom of a Europa or an Enceladus, one of these ocean worlds.
Right.
But if this fundamental reaction is taking place and you can have production of these types of chemicals, it seems to me, you know, life on Earth at least usually finds a way.
Yeah, that's so cool. Okay, so now I have to ask. So you are an oceanographer, but did you always want to study the deep, deep part of the ocean? Or how did you get where you are now?
Yeah, no.
That was a definitive no.
Kids, you know, I grew up right around the Jacques Cousteau generation.
Yes.
I also grew up in the landlocked Midwest. And most of what I thought about the ocean was from television or the aquarium. So yes. Dolphins, coral reefs, and sharks, you know, the big three. I was lucky enough to go to college. And while I was in college, I learned about, you know, things that weren't taught at my high school. I learned about geology. I learned about the ocean. And when I was in college, there was this very exciting paper that came out that said they had found evidence of life in a Martian meteorite. So a meteorite that had landed in Antarctica from Mars.
Right.
And all of the evidence for life was actually based on chemistry and microbes. And I was like, that's crazy, right? That we're inferring something that's happening a million whatever miles away from this rock that landed on Earth. And it sort of piqued my interest in space. I really hadn't thought that much about it. You know, learning about the ocean, learning about geology, I just kind of fell in love with volcanoes and thinking about, you know, what could we learn from them that would help us in this search.
Yes.
So it wasn't a straight path, but.
No, but it was a curious one, which is what led you from one to the other, which is what is the best type of path, right?
Yeah. And I should just say that that paper that piqued my interest was later proven to be totally not true because the tools the scientists had available to them at the time were not state of the art, right? Things have changed. And with new tools, you know, the lines of evidence have fallen. And that's, you know, part of the reason scientists decided we really need to go to Mars and get new samples.
Right.
Bring them back and do the best possible analysis. Now we know how to do this. And so that's also been really fun to watch the progression of that field in terms of how to do that science the best.
Well, I like to tell my students that science is not always absolute, right? It changes. And just what you said, the technology, we learn new things as we go along. And sometimes we have to reevaluate. Yeah, we thought this was totally true. And then you're like, not so much, right?
Yeah.
But we're always looking forward, I feel, with science. You're always looking forward to the next thing. How can we get there and solve the problems, right?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it's a very profound and difficult problem to solve. You know, proving that there is life beyond Earth. And I think now we're probably the best prepared we've ever been to tackle it.
That's awesome. Cool.
Yeah.
Speaking of looking to the future, for you, Dr. Julie, you've already taken samples. You've already been down to the bottom of the ocean. What is next on the Dr. Julie list of, is there a different part of the ocean you want to go get samples from? What is it you're doing next?
Well, I mean, we actually work all over the globe. A large part of my research program is working with a lot of different types of scientists to, you know, make good maps of the seafloor, look for interesting features, and just go figure out what's happening down there. So that means we work with geologists and chemists. We work with animal biologists, and we do a lot of engineering, which we've already talked a little bit about.
Yes.
So we've worked all over the Pacific and the Atlantic and the Caribbean. So, you know, what hasn't been looked at, what might be missing? It's an interesting type of research because I know at least when I was in middle school, I was taught, you know, you need to have a hypothesis.
Yes.
And then you make your plan. But a lot of it is like you know, it's really deep here. There's this weird geology happening with plate tectonics. Let's go make a map and see. I bet something's happening. And then you look at the map and you're like, oh, there's definitely something interesting happening with a volcano there. It's basic research in that way, right? Very exploratory. At some of the other places on the seafloor that I've visited multiple times, we can build hypothesis-driven research, right? Sure. Where we know enough to hypothesize about what we might see. And one thing we're doing this summer, for example, we're going off in the Northeast Pacific Ocean, about 300 miles offshore from Oregon, where there's an underwater volcano we work at. We're deploying some new instrumentation down there to try to figure out, you know, we now know there's all these microbes, they're eating the chemical energy and they're growing and they're thriving. And now we want to figure out who's eating them. So kind of going up a step in the food web, right? And so we have a new sampler we're going to deploy to try to, you know, figure it out. Who's eating them? How quickly? What does it mean for the carbon budget down there? Things like that.
Oh, I love that.
I love that. It sounds like so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah,
very excited to get back to sea.
Oh, absolutely. And it's so incredible that we can learn all of this on our own planet,
yes,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I am, you know, Earth first kind of girl.
I like that. And actually, the way you were just describing 300 miles off the coast of Oregon, there's a volcano we do some work at. I was picturing the globe that's in the room near me. I feel like you look at a globe or a world map a lot differently than the rest of us do. The rest of us are looking at like a map of the United States or all the land masses going, there's a cool thing here, a cool thing there. I feel like you're doing that with all of the oceans.
Yeah. And I have to tell you, like, it just took a long time to get that point of view though, right? It's not like when I was a kid or, you know, I grew up east of the Mississippi River. I'd never seen a volcano in my life, right?
Yes.
I mean, I was actually shocked when I went to the Pacific Northwest and I was like, what? There are giant volcanoes out here. A lot of how you see the world is what's around you. I still live east of the Mississippi, but I think a lot about what's happening, you know, beyond the continents now.
Oh, yeah. Well, this has been great, Dr. Julie. Now we're at the point in our show where we ask if you have a challenge for our listeners. I'm curious to see what you're going to have them do.
One of the biggest challenges for us working in the deep sea is dealing with the crushing pressure of water. So I thought it'd be really fun to kind of play with pressure, doing a pretty simple experiment. You can just do it in your kitchen, in a sink or in a bathtub, to kind of look at the differences in pressure and kind of what the weight of water looks like.
Oh,
okay.
Because, you know, even if you've just dove to the bottom of a swimming pool, you felt that pressure in your ears maybe when you got a little bit deep.
Right.
But the water pressure experiment that I've shared, you know, you can actually see those differences rather than feeling them. And you don't have to get wet in the process.
Well, listeners, be sure to go to our website, solveitforkids.com. We'll have all the details about Dr. Julie's challenge there. This has been such a wonderful episode. I know we like to have space episodes for Jeff, but I love Aquanauts and I love the ocean. That's my choice. So thank you so much for being on Solve It for Kids, Dr. Julie.
Thank you, Dr. Julie.
Yeah, it was great to meet you guys.
I don't think there's ever a time when going deep into the ocean isn't absolutely fascinating. Huh, Jen?
Oh, it's so fascinating. I mean, can you imagine going down in the Alvin? I think that is so...
I've been imagining it since Dr. Julie started talking.
Right? It's so cool. And I hope all of you guys go out and do the experiment where you can actually use the water bottle and find out that as you go down, down, down into the ocean, the pressure goes up and so the water shoots out of the bottle faster. I'm going to try this one. Are you going to do this one with your daughter, Jeff?
Absolutely. And since I'm in Colorado, we're going to do it on a nice day so we can do it outside and make kind of a mess. But yeah, you don't need an entire ocean to do great experiments with water to understand some of the ocean principles that Dr. Julie was teaching us.
Oh, it's so much fun. So if any of you do this, please share it with us. You can find more information about the exact ways to do the water bottle experiment on our website, which is solveforkids.com. And then tag us on our social media, which is at KidSolve at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
And as soon as we get back to the surface from this deep dive into the ocean, we'll see you next time on
Solve It for Kids.